Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Remember, though, the 5 to 10 years of experience is actually just built into the template. That's not actually a requirement or anything. It's automatically in there.
Don't forget the 15 years of Kubernetes experience that's required if you want to work at some place, even though Kubernetes, I think, is about 6-7 years old.
I think it's a perfect example, though. Somebody coming from outside of traditional security that'll probably do really well within security. I'm seeing that more and more. Some of the best people are rooted somewhere completely else. Now, you do get some that come from rooted within IT, but as long as you have a bed of knowledge that you're deep in and can translate that into security, the world is yours.
Yeah, I want to dive into, though, just peel apart something that you just said, Brian, around the combination of experience and certifications. Too often, people look at one or the other of those as the path in and forget about the other. You know, it's what certification should I do to get a job in the field? And that topic often, it falls really flat when it comes to my ears. Because certifications are only as good as that which you are able to practice them, or that which you come into the certification with experience. Certs are not designed to my view of certifications is not that they were there to slam a bunch of information into your brain, then slide a test under your nose before you've even moved out of the seat, pass the test and go, cool, I've got to insert 5 letters here. It really, for me, is about a certification that's rooted in experience, and the certification is the confirmation that you really do have and know that topic.
So to drill further into that, Dan, then, are you talking about certifications that should have a time in seat requirement, or are you talking about changing the way we actually do the tests where it's more hands-on and practical now?
Yes to both, but I think more importantly, I think more is the that there's certifications with time and seat requirements or actual experience requirements hold a lot more weight for me when I'm looking at them as a hiring manager than do those that are, you know, boot camp, 3 days test, boom, I'm certified. That doesn't tell me anything other than you were able to retain information for 3 days. And a stack of 5 of those also doesn't tell me anything. Actually, it does tell me something, but it's not necessarily what you want it to tell me. But I think the other king is, though, some certifications that are rooted in that, the free market, you know, I'm a big fan of the free market. I think, you know, we're all capitalists to some extent. But the market has taken and said, how can we exploit this and make the most money out of it? And has set up places where, you know, even those with the time and seat requirement are becoming more and more disingenuous. And it's up to those that are sponsoring those tests to make sure that they keep the sanctity of the test, of the certification intact, so that I, as a hiring manager, still look at it as something valid rather than just a tax you pay every year.
Now, I will say, so Brian brought up a good organization, SANS. I think while there are some certs that are going that way and becoming, I don't want to say less and less relevant, but easier and easier to acquire and maintain, SANS has done a really good job. A lot of their tests have number one, gone to hands-on. So yes, you do have the boot camp. You have to go through in-depth training. And by the way, the training there is some of the best you will ever find. I mean, if you look at the practitioners that are teaching that, they are in this day in, day out. It's not ethereal. This is what they do for a living. It's phenomenal. But the hands-on testing, I think, is great. Instead of, I'm going to give you 4 answers. Let's see if you can guess the right one. It's you have to know what you're actually doing. And to the other side of that, for retaining those certs, you know, we've all seen the continuing education credits where you could essentially list anything you did. Well, I thought of security today, so therefore I'm claiming that for an hour. SANS doesn't go with that. I actually am renewing one of my certs, I think it was last year. They challenged multiple rounds of, they challenged and threw out some of the things that credits that I had put in there. They make it tough to keep those certs. So kudos to them that, you know, if you find somebody just got a, so SANS would come through as it show up as GIAC. Those are solid certifications. And then Brian, back to your point and to somebody asking where they were going within security, that's the right question. And SANS is actually a good organization that if you look at their roadmap with all the different certs, to start having that conversation, because there are so many different directions you can go into the security realm. I mean, if you're going into application security, network security, infrastructure, there's so many different routes, and it's not like Pokemon catch them all, right? Depending on if you're trying to be to a breadth of knowledge, or if you're trying to get deep into to one specific area.
And SANS long ago, even I guess 20 years ago now, when I think I took my first SANS class in 1999, 2000. And even then they were talking about the practical portion of the certificate of the certification being equal to the work involved, being equal to that which you do in a master's thesis. Mm-hmm. And I think that has persisted in that. You're seeing other certifications attempt to equate themselves to a master's degree. And perhaps if done in their original intent, could be seen that way, but it's not a guarantee if somebody has them that's the level of studying and work that went into it.
Right.
But at the same time, work doesn't equal, effort does not equal output. Just because they put a lot of time into it doesn't mean they don't have the qualifications to meet the certificate. Easy for me to say.
Very true.
I'm going to share, not right now. You guys probably see me looking up as you guys are talking. And it got me thinking.
It's an audio cast, Brian. No one can see you looking
right,
up.
Nobody can see me. But I'm sitting here looking up. I have a friend of mine that I was talking about earlier, where that conversation originally came from, on whether going back to school or finishing out, you know, some certifications. And he put together what he called the entry-level resources for information security. And he had shared it over to me. And I was looking through it. And this was, you know, a month or two ago, and he continues to update it. But he put it together for a friend who was thinking about getting into cybersecurity. And the question his friend had asked was the same thing. You know, do I go take classes at a university, or do I begin my path down different certifications, or do I just try to find an entry-level position? So what he did was he put this kind of security template or booklet together. And on the left, it has projects. It has resources and guides, entry-level resources. It has tools, Metasploit, OpenVAS, PowerShell, fun tools like Hack the Box, Try Hack Me. But it also has a list of what he says are from certifications from top to bottom, different things you can do. And of course, in there is also SANS as well. But I thought it was really interesting because I've actually gone through it. And it's actually helped me to understand really how many different certifications are out there and which ones would actually be considered entry level, right? Rather than me, you know, trying to click on and saying, oh, this could be useful for me. So I'll share this with you guys. But I thought that was really, really cool. And I told them, I go, if I were you, I'd share that with the general public, because there's a lot of people out there that probably have the same questions and they're afraid or just don't know who to ask, right?
Is it posted somewhere where we can link people to it, or is it still a private resource?
You know, I had him share it at one point on LinkedIn. I'll go in and see if I can find it. I actually just shot him a note and said, hey, if you made any updates, shoot it over to me, because I'd like to share it with the team, because I found it useful as well. So
good.
Well, and again, it's someone in the industry, you know, that can talk to the ones he's done and the ones that he's thinking about doing. So to hear, you know, from both you, Dan, and Eric, you know, what the usefulness is as well, I think is also important as people make that journey into security.
Absolutely. And then there's the other leg of the triumvirate here is formal education. Both the things we've talked about are either practical. I don't know that we call it more ad hoc or industry education, but what about formal training? What about you know, traditional academics going for a CS degree, going for some of the more more practical IT or IS degrees that are in business schools and computer schools, and then eventually for master's, PhD, or JDs. Eric, where's your head on, what's your thinking on formal education in the context of a working security professional?
Yeah, so from a formal education perspective, I think it's important, and it's not important necessarily what the degree is in, right? That, you know, you talk about CS or, you know, pick your degree, insert it here.
You're talking about a bachelor's here, right?
Whether it be a bachelor's or a master's.
Okay.
If we're doing formal education, because I think what it does provide is a mindset of how to research, a mindset of how to take learnings, translate learnings, and being able to give that back and help others learn or help move something in a certain direction. I think that's really what that provides, that, you know, you are likely getting a person that's fairly well-rounded. Now, there is an element of, if you have somebody with, you know, my master's is in information security, I think you do have to be careful with some of those, depending on the institution that they're coming from, that you may get somebody that comes with a lot of ethereal kind of ideas that aren't really rooted in practical applications, right? And how businesses actually do security. So I think that can be dangerous. You know, I was talking to my father-in-law about he's a general contractor. And we were talking about building licenses, and he was talking about, yeah, you know, to get through school and get a building license, a lot of the things that you learn, you'll never actually use on the job site because they're so far behind with those licenses. And right. I think you could run the same risk with formal education, that when somebody comes out, that if that's all they've got behind them, you still need some time in seat, some time working with the actual people in the field to root that in reality and how we're doing things.
And there continue to be theoretical programs, those, you know, traditional computer science, that are about the science of it, that are giving people the basis to be able to do future research. But there are increasing numbers of practical programs taught by practitioners that come in to give you a real world. So you walk out of the university with a degree and actual real world interaction, not something that was developed, you know, in 1977 and is still taught today.
Right.
those do happen, but I think universities are becoming quite wise to the fact that there is that there is a practical need. I equate it to the fact that when I walked out of college, nobody ever taught me how to, you know, balance a checkbook. That was something you had to learn. Granted, not about security, but just practical things. I learned how to learn, so I then learned how to do it. But there was definitely some practical things that were missing at the time. They've filled in a lot of those gaps in the last years since I left university.
Right.
You make a great point there, because I can remember the first time I learned about investing, 401k, why it was important to do the max, everything else. Our transport phenomena class, Dr. Hawley, the final for transport phenomena was 2 weeks before the end of the year. So you didn't technically have to come those last 2 weeks, but he said, whoever wants to come, he goes, I'm going to spend the last 2 weeks teaching you about what it is you need to do when you get your first job, because all of you are going to get a job.
Awesome.
And we came in and he literally went through and started putting up on the board, if this is how much you're making right out the gate, and they're going to offer, you know, whether it's 2%, 3% match, how much you're going to put in. He goes, you're going to go and do the max. He goes, and you're never going to touch it, and watch this. And you break it down, and we're all math guys, right? It's all going across the board. And you're like, we never took the time to do that. It wasn't part of any class that we were in. And then he started breaking that down even more, you know, on other things, and why it was important to have 3 months worth of your pay, you know, in the bank. And it was just, and why it was important to buy a home at what time period or your, what interest rate, you know, and all of these were life lessons that nobody ever taught you. And I never sat down and had that same conversation with my parents. I'm sure some parents do. So those are really beneficial. Flipping back though to what you said, Dan, I wondered this, and granted, I'm not in going back to school right now, but I look at how fast things change in security. you know, as we talk about just in the last year too, like we talk about the perimeter coming down, threat actors changing, you look at different techniques, tactics, you look at the automation that threat actors are using, but also that security companies are now using. And I look back to the books that I was studying, you know, and you go back to Fluid Flow, you go back to Thermo, right? Like that book had been reproduced for 30 years. They were just going, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
you would really have to stay on top of it. And I think when you were saying that's where you get some really good security minded, whether professionals, whether it's CISOs, security experts that are going back in that work for universities, because I've seen it on a lot of people's LinkedIn profiles or in conversation that they say, yeah, I'm also, you know, an adjunct professor at this university. And it's like, oh, wow, that's impressive, right? Like going back and it's almost like you're helping mentor. You're helping mentor the next, you know, right, students that are going to come out in the security field.
Right. Now, yeah. The counter argument to that is so while we have all of the technological advancements, the attackers evolving and all of that stuff, there are fundamentals in security that have never changed, right? As we go into access controls, as we go into the different constructs, least privilege mantra, layers of security, and some of those persist no matter what the technologies are that we're inserting to them. So those things, by and large, you can continue to teach going through control frameworks and all of that stuff. Now, control frameworks get updated with some technology and some new techniques and stuff. There is an element that has to be learned, but there is definitely that part of the courses that has to be kind of the evolving world of what we're living in and the attacks that we're actually seeing.
Yeah. Also, you know, we talked about base degrees or entry degrees, excuse me, but I guess I'll share a little bit of my own internal struggle. I've continued to think of the past 15 years about whether or not to go back to school. I'm a relatively successful practitioner. I've got 25 years of experience, but I continually wonder whether or not going back for, let's say, a PhD or for a JD, because understanding the law is becoming increasingly important to security and privacy professionals and leaders, because that's a lot of where we get our guidance now. And I've struggled a lot with this, you know, a lot of back and forth. Would I get it? What's the value in it? Is it worth upending my career and basically stopping my career for some period of time and going back for these degrees? And I keep coming back to at this point that I have not pursued either one, but I could see a way that something like a JD for me, like the last year of law school, would be really interesting, but I have to get through the first 2 years of it, which I have gotten most of that content. According to many lawyers and many attorneys and general counsels that I've spoken with, I have those experiences. I understand those fundamentals well enough, but I'd have to sit through the first 2 years to get to the part that would be really beneficial. Same thing with a PhD.
Life lesson credits don't transfer over to credits in the classroom.
Oh, if only. I worked on 25 acquisitions in 3 years means I can sit. Can I clep out of the class on mergers and acquisitions or acquisition law? You know, there's just, you know, those kind of things, which would be you know, really interesting to do. But I think the fundamental here is that for me, the practical experience, I don't think the degrees at this point, aside, unless I wanted to go become a privacy attorney, none of those degrees really buy me anything at this point in my career. Maybe when my son's off at school and I have empty nest syndrome and I want to go back and just spend some time learning, perhaps. But at this point, you know, I've made that decision, but I struggle with it. And I suspect a lot of people in our field do struggle with whether or not to go back. And what does a degree get you once you're in the field? So, you know, Eric or Brian, if you have thoughts on you know, going back or additional value that comes out of a degree once you're in.
So I've been going through the same debate as well, looking at it. And I think you have to determine what is your end goal. And if your end goal is to advance your current position, probably not a lot there, right? You know, I think experience at this point trumps the classroom. But if you're looking to start advancing the field, the community, more, there are elements that gives you even more credibility bringing those degrees to the table, whether you have a JD or a PhD, depending what the PhD is in. I think there can be a lot of benefits. I mean, if you're going to start writing a lot of articles and, you know, maybe start this podcast or something, I don't know, maybe there is some benefit there. But yeah, JD is one, definitely one that I've kept toying with, that and an MBA. Just kind of rounding out the business elements to everything.
Leave no stone unturned, have them all. Right?
I was not going to say it jokingly, but kind of jokingly is, why not get both?
There are JD MBA programs out there. They're a lot more prevalent when you're a traditional student, when you're coming out coming out of your undergrad. You go in, you get your MBA, you get your JD in 4 years together, and off you go to work for, you know, to be a general counsel somewhere.
So what I was going to say too, though, is I also look at, depending on when you say what your end goal is. So if you're saying, I want to go work for a Fortune 50 company or possibly a Fortune 20, the approval is going to come from the board, and the board isn't going to take the time 100% to get to know Dan. They're going to take the time to get to know Dan's background. And how does this read? And right off the bat, because I know there's practitioners just in the state of Michigan that have PhD in front of their name. And I've heard before, in with somebody not even knowing them, they're like, oh yeah, but he's a PhD security professional with, and then goes through his entire resume that's on LinkedIn basically, without ever knowing him, he's validating that person for the entire room, right? And everybody in the room's like, oh wow. But they've never met him.
In the same way, a CISSP gets you on the pile, or doesn't get you filtered out of the pile when you apply for a role.
Right. Yeah. So you're arguing then that a degree is a CYA in the case of a breach?
I'm not arguing it in that sense. What I'm saying is, it's not just building your resume to put it down there, right? You're building your resume as a talking point in closed circles for some of the biggest boardrooms to make a decision if you're the right person. Think about this. If you were, and I look at this from a previous company I worked at, if you were a very large multinational company, if you're, let's say, a Japanese company or a German company over here with a very, very large operation, having someone that has that JD, that law portion of it, says, you know what, I like this candidate better than this one because he can help us understand some of the legal issues that we have around privacy and security. You check two boxes that they're currently struggling with, and they've been paying for outside counsel. And that's very expensive. A board looks at that and says, how much have we spent in the last year? Oh, well over $600,000. Really? And what did we spend last year? Well, last year we had an incident, and then we had this issue over in Europe, you know, and it's like, bring them in.
Yeah.
You haven't even been validated or back channeled by anybody else, but that was on there. And I could see that being important. One of the reasons I was reaching out to my friend when I was having the conversation about that resource sheet that he had put together with all that stuff on it, I was asking him, like, are there any certifications you think that I could take or should take that you think I would be able to go into and handle in the next year? And he's like, what's the purpose of doing it? And I said to him, I go, I just want to do it. Like, I'm doing it more for the conversation fact of, whenever I talk with engineers, people in this field, in the security realm, look at sales guys as strictly sales guys. I came from an engineering background, and in my previous role, we only hired engineers as sales guys, right? Because they had to be able to go through and show drawings and prove things out. But very much in the information technology, you'll have sales guys, like you said, come from all different backgrounds. And getting in the weeds is sometimes considered getting out of your swim lane. But I very much like to know how things work. It's one of the reasons I like kind of bouncing things off both you, Eric, and Dan, because not only do I learn a lot, but you guys also put me on the right path of where to go next. And I think a lot of people in security or information technology also lack mentors, right? Which I think there's a lot of good organizations out there right now. I know we've talked MCWT, great organization, mentoring women in technology. I know we've also talked
about Stump for Mentor Corps.
MentorCore.
MentorCore. WAMSA is in there. There's a lot of great organizations.
MentorCore is a project I've started up to try and mentor security risk, ethics, and compliance professionals.
And in the other conversation to that too, when we said who makes great security people, right? Like, and we were talking about that article written by Alok, where he wrote in, you know, when he's in doing consulting and somebody asks, well, are you saying that we need to go hire, you know, an expert security analyst? And he says, well, you probably already have one on your team. They're just located in your finance department.
For right.
One, yeah, they know where you make money, where you lose money, so they know your business. They're also very analytical, and they're great at going through data and breaking it down. The other thing that he didn't mention there that I was going to bring up was they're also really good under fire. When you look at the end of quarters and the end of year, they spend hours burning the midnight oil every night, crunching the numbers, trying to figure out where a mistake was made. You know, they're doing the audit for the very, very top management, and they understand what the top management wants to know. And I think that goes right to risk too. When you're going in and you're analyzing, you know, an incident or anything else, you got a very good analyst there.
Right.
But I digress.
I like the fact that Dan and I were references essentially your security GPS. Turn right now.
Turn left. Go into the water.
Take the roundabout.
I know. Then I always got to double check too. I'm like, are they being serious?
Trust us. Implicit trust. You'll be okay.
Don't have. If you ask questions, it invalidates our advice.
Just click the link.
So, and not to throw anything else out there, to stir the pot even further. But, you know, Dan, you were talking about kind of in the struggle of going back to school or not going back to school, maybe waiting until you were an empty nester. At that point, are you doing it to prove something to yourself, or are you doing it just because you want to do it? You're analytical. There's a learning there that maybe you're not going to get with a certification, or there's something that that maybe, you know, just going back to offers you that you're not going to get from just the experience.
So there's a loaded question, that more loaded than I think you even expected. So in my family, I come from a family of people in higher ed and have done very good things with their lives and have taught. And so I am Wallowitz in my family. I'm the only one without a doctorate. So there's a little bit of that. But deep down, it really is for me about, I've never been able to stop learning. And I think that putting some theoretical, I've spent my entire career in practical experience, and there's some theoretical pieces I want to take and do. That's why the PhD in something like security or computer science really interests me, to be able to take and put some theoretical things, take my practical experience and apply them to theory to be able to do something interesting. The other part, or something specifically interesting, not to say the things I've done previously to that were not interesting, but there's some of that taking what I've learned in real world and applying it to be able to solve a problem. The other thing is, as I come on in my career, as I continue on in my career, doing something meaningful increases in importance with every step I take. So if you look at my career path, I've tried to do things that continue to help the world, continue to make things better, continue to educate and give back to society, and do those kinds of things. And that continues that path. It's just looking ahead down that road. Would I want to do? Do I want to do it just to do it? You bet.
Is that one of the reasons you started MentorCore, or built? Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in giving back. I've had some amazing mentors in my career. I've had people who have led me. Hopefully we're giving you the same mentoring, Brian, as the great mentoring that I've received from bosses, friends, people unrelated who have just given their own time. And then watching my parents, who were both, in, you know, both instructors, mentoring the students that they worked with in and helping them to achieve great careers and great outcomes in their lives, it was almost a, it's my turn. It's my time to do that and try and try and provide that. So I try and do that, take that kind of care with the people I work with, and trying to bring that kind of culture to an industry where we don't often have that. It's a, it's an isolating field. We are often introverted, looking down, heads down, focused on the thing, the problem we have. And we share information about those, but it's not often an industry that says, hey, open up and be a little more vulnerable and tell me the things that you have that we need help with. And I will help you. I'll help to help you down to achieve them. And that's what we want to do, is start to pair people up, start to find mentors for people, and just create a cult, a community, to help people grow themselves and their careers. And I, yeah, it was just my way of giving back for all the people, paying it forward for all the people who paid to me.
And I think that's a good point. Anybody who may be listening, looking to break into the field, change goals, change careers, or anything like that, you know, reach out, whether it be Mentor Corps, MCWT, WAMSA. There are plenty of organizations, places to plug in. Yeah. Find a mentor and help somebody, find somebody that can guide you through your career path and where you want to go.
Yeah.
Even the Cloud Security Alliance. I can remember the last face-to-face meeting we had, which was over in Plymouth. There was a gentleman that came up to talk to me, just because of some questions I asked. And we were talking, and he goes, hey, I'm just a student, right? He goes, because I go, do you have a business card? He goes, no, I'm just a student. He goes, but I was listening to the questions you asked. Like, he's like, hey, how do I engage with people, or how do I do this? I go, there's a lot of people here that you could probably just go up and talk to and say, hey, I'm a student. I'm looking for an entry-level position. Where do I go to look for those, right? Because you're in a room with a ton of professionals that all know people, and it's a very tight-knit family from what I found. You know, if somebody needs somebody, they probably already talked to five other people, right?
Right.
And I think a lot of people knowing how the security world works also believe very heavily in the idea of mentoring.
100%. It's so, I don't think you're going to find anybody that goes, you know what, I went into information security because I heard it pays so well. The hours are real easy. It's a nice and easy job. Nobody. That doesn't happen. There is a passion for what we do. And part of that passion is giving back to people and mentoring the next set of individuals that are going to lead the security community.
And the advice, one, you know, we talk about, you know, asking people about themselves, but if there's somebody else that you want to interact with, I was lucky. I grew up and I grew my career in Chicago, and the cohort of people that we all came up together have done some amazing things and are amazing roles. And I want to introduce people to them, and they want to introduce people to me. So if there's somebody you know that knows somebody, going back to what LinkedIn was before it became an advertising juggernaut, this is one of the things that this field is great at. But it's not easy to ask, I know, but know that you can. Ask somebody you know, ask us, ask somebody you know to say, hey, can you introduce me to insert CISO or lead engineer or developer at this place? And I'm pretty sure that they will, because I'm sure somebody did the same for them.
Yeah, what I just want to touch on that right there. I actually had a very interesting phone call this week with somebody that reached out to me 2 or 3 days ago. It was in the evening, and they just said, the text read, it was via LinkedIn, a message, and it said, do you have time to talk tonight? Or no, it didn't say tonight. It said, do you have time to talk? In the company he worked for, I knew some individuals there, and they do, you know, security risk analysis, they do pen testing, et cetera. So the back part of my head is, there's probably some type of incident or something, breach at someone they work with, wants to reach out. And I said, does it need to be tonight, or can it be tomorrow morning? Cause it was already like 8 o'clock. And he said, oh, tomorrow morning's fine. And I go, no problem. And I gave him my information. And then he came back and said, just so you understand, I'm not looking for any services or product or anything like that. He goes, I just want to talk to you about your role. And I was like, okay. Well, then I quickly had looked online, and he had also put a message up, and it had said, you know, I don't have it in front of me, but basically said, looking for other security, sales-minded professionals in the security and IT world to talk to about some of the struggles during work from home, et cetera. And I said, I think I know what he wants to talk about. So this wasn't mentoring in the sense of security and going back to school, et cetera. But I picked up the phone the next day and it was only 30 minutes, but we ended up talking for an hour and 15. And he started to explain how he was using LinkedIn and some of the things he was doing. And I said, do yourself a favor. Don't use LinkedIn the way you're using it. And I said, you're going to push people away faster than you're going to pull them forward. I go, if there's one mistake I made coming over into, you know, this business, I came from automotive where, you know, there's only a handful of tier ones in the world that make some of our products. Every OE wants to talk to us. That's not the same here. There's thousands of companies that make similar products and they're all vying for time. And if you use those platforms and reach out or send notes or find people's phone numbers and do it that way, you're going to push people further away than you are going to pull them forward. So it was a very interesting conversation. He had expressed some of the things that had happened over the last few months and how it was so frustrating or so demoralizing because some of the things people said to him, you know, like in, I could hear, feel that moment when you were just talking about like giving back. Cause I know in my career, I had somebody who very much mentored me at a time when I thought I knew a lot and I was probably pushing people away.
Was it the movie Glenn Ross?
But I look back too, and this person near and dear to my heart lives overseas now in Asia, but really helped mentor me. You know, so I, like you said, it's very important to have that. And if you can pay it back. And I told this individual, feel free to reach out whenever you want. I didn't necessarily give him advice on selling. I gave him advice on selling himself, right? Sell who you are first and the rest will follow.
It's build relationships, not contacts.
Yeah.
I like it. Absolutely. So coming back around to education, there's this circle. There was a commercial in Chicago when I was growing up. Can't get a loan because you can't get credit. Can't get credit because you can't get a loan. Those that know me, I rattle this off a lot. It's this circle. And how do you break into the circle? And so the question is, what comes first in when you're trying to get into the security field? Education or experience? We just spent a whole bunch of time talking about the value of practical experience. But without the certification, sometimes people don't get the chance to get the experience. And without the experience, they may not qualify to get the certification or to get the education. So
is that similar to Austin Powers where he goes, I'm sad because I eat. I eat because I'm sad.
Exactly. It's a vicious
cycle.
I love it. Yeah, exactly. It's this circle. And how do you break into it? Education versus experience, which comes first? And in the modern day, we talk about practical advice. Practical advice for somebody just starting out that wants to come into the security field. And we're seeing a lot of people coming out of other fields that have some, you know, that have business experience, maybe not security or technical, but want to come into the field. Where do you point them? Where do you start?
Well, Dan, it depends.
That's my answer, and I've patented it, and you owe me $5 copyright.
It's in the mail.
Thanks.
Snail mail. We're going old school.
It depends button. Boom. It depends. Yeah, but it's true. It does. It does depend. But I mean, there's another aspect there too. Like you say, here's the different organizations you can reach out to. And just looking at that sometimes can be intimidating, right? Because you pull up the name of the organization, and right there on the list of people in the organization is like, oh, you know what I mean? And Eric, I'm throwing this out. I'll use the CSA as an example. If you pulled up the CSA, the list of people that sit on the board of CSA reads like the who's who of security in the Detroit area, right? And not to give Eric a big head over there.
Except
I'm just
for
saying,
that one guy.
Yeah. But and if you were entry level, you're like, maybe that isn't the right organization. And as you reach out and you show up to a meeting or two, you see it, right? That there's a ton of people in this room that have years of education. They're still showing up to learn more and talk with other people. Same thing with MCWT. And that's one of the reasons I got involved there. I actually got involved because I wanted to do mentoring. And I look back to like when I did mentoring in college, we used to go to the high schools and the middle schools as chemical engineers. You had to do a certain amount of time. And I got involved with AICHE, which is the American Institute of Chemical Engineers. And we used to go in and do all these little experiments. And I thought it was really cool. And I look now where I'm at in my career. And I know that there's a few things, a few points of guidance I was given that definitely steered me in a better direction for myself. And if I didn't have that or somebody didn't give that to me, and sometimes it wasn't even me asking. It was just somebody that got to know me and they could pick up on it and then say it. So reach out. Don't be afraid to reach out. Even if it feels uncomfortable, reach out, touch, you know, call, figure out if there's someone you can talk with. And then, I don't know.
I was just about to sing this up, reach out and
Depeche Mode this early in the morning, Eric. I love it.
Yeah. No, going back to the experience thing is so interesting because you have two pieces of experience, right? You have direct experience, which is doing what you're going to do in the job, or you have tangential experience. You know, I look at Brian, look at what you brought to the table. I mean, coming into of the three of us, you're the most recent to the security realm, but you've got so much knowledge within engineering that you've been able to apply. So that tangential knowledge has given you a great foundation to be able to move into the security realm and kind of put constructs around it and being able to excel. So I think you have to have experience somewhere. And it doesn't mean that you have to be in a job for 10, 15 years to gain that experience. Some of it you can do on your own. You know, if you look at, you know, I think, what was it, one of our text threads that we were going back and forth on the definition of a hacker, right? And the hacker used to be somebody that just tinkered with things. Mm-hmm. That is a great way to start. Play with things, break things. Doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a computer. It can be anything, right? And they can be experienced. Get involved. Get involved with local organizations. Get involved with, you know, right now, I think schools need a lot of help. You know, as we were talking about the virtual learning and all of that stuff, it's an interesting environment now. And I'm sure that there's ways to get involved and help out there. But create some experience. It doesn't necessarily have to be directly in security.
I was just thinking on the top of my head when you mentioned that. So thanks for the compliment, Eric. I appreciate it. In earlier when you said you could have any type of education, I was going to jokingly throw out, what if it was culinary? And then as we've been sitting here talking, I was thinking to myself, if somebody was an actual line cook, but was studying anything technical, they would really fit in well in a security role. Because once they get some of that technical acumen behind them, but they've been a line cook for X number of years, they're used to the under fire part. When the rush hits from 6 to 8 o'clock and the kitchen's hot and you're sweating and you're going crazy, when there's an incident or something happens. So if you're going to school and you're getting a technical background, but as a part-time job, you were a line cook. And this is just, you know, Brian Schneebly throwing out something crazy and wild. But it's like you said, Eric, any type of experience that you were able to handle yourself under fire, under pressure, but also had some type of technical experience with that or problem solving experience, et cetera, allows you to bring that in. And it's what you make of it, right? Also, not to pivot, but Eric,
When you
just pivoted and said, you made the comment about, you know, there's a lot of schools that could use support right now as well as everyone gets back. There was an interesting post, and I'd have to pull it up. A gentleman from CBI just wrote, and it said, "This is the next snow day." And what it was referring to was schools being shut down because they were being attacked. And I know we had some texts back and forth, and there's been some DDoS attacks down in Miami, Florida, all around, where the students themselves are trying to figure out ways where they can shut down the school so that a day of learning has now been compromised. And the article was talking about these are the next snow days. And I thought that was very interesting because it really is the next snow day, right?
Right. It's concerning, you know, as we've talked here, that if we look at a lot of our organizations have security teams built in, by and large, I think we know what we're doing. We're not perfect by any means, but we've got a team behind us that's pretty solid and knows where we're going. But all of a sudden, you know, we've had this shift, and I get it, but we took educational institutions, kind of that K through 12, who a lot of them, I mean, I don't know, Dan, your thoughts on this one, but a lot of them probably don't have a lot of security experience, and said, here you go, you're all online now, let's see what happens. You know, and I, you know, there are some successes that will come out. You know, if you look just around the area in Michigan, that some school districts, it looks like it went off pretty well day one. And then there's others where I feel like the teachers were thrown into Office 365 and stuff, and there was no training or anything. It's just, hey, you're going to use these tools. Yeah, but how do I use those tools? What am I actually doing with those? Where it was just kind of haphazardly, well, you need a technology, we'll throw a technology at you and the technology will solve it. Well, no, technology doesn't solve anything.
Right. And even before that, the purchase of the technology, there was all of this rush to buy stuff. There was a lot of spending. Some companies did very well off of some software companies did very well off of this pandemic. But like you said, Eric, a lot of the, especially in the K-12s, there just isn't a lot of depth. There's technical depth, like how do we support 14,000 devices that we distribute out? There's technical depth, like how do we interconnect learning management systems to Google for authentication? There's that kind of thing. But there isn't a lot of depth when asking the question about the, how is this data used? The, you know, the privacy end. And that's, I think that's a whole other topic on this. But there also isn't a lot of depth of the integrity and availability portions of security that go along with deploying some of these things at scale. When you're trying to do it in mass, I don't know about you, but whenever I've been in the middle of an incident and you make a decision about how to remediate or how to address something, it's done with less thought, with less forethought than if you were going to take the time to really think through and plan and coordinate the way you would in a normal technology deployment. And I think that's the way a lot of K-12s had to approach this. You know, it's not a failing of the districts, it's a failing of the situation, and they did the best they could with what they had. They don't have a lot of this ancillary support. Some districts have the access to local universities to ask the questions, but I think it's up to us as a security community to reach out to our districts and say, hey, we're happy to be part of this. If you're on a school board and you're a security practitioner, or a technology or if you're just listening to this and you're on the school board, advise the technology director to reach out to somebody in the community who can help them with security matters as you're going through all this, because we're setting up these children on technology without really understanding, and maybe not all of the vetting that needs to go into it. And just because something says that they are compliant to various regulations doesn't necessarily mean they are. Just because something is intended, quote unquote, intended for under 13s or for K-12, doesn't mean it necessarily has the best interests of the student in mind. Right. So this is one of those cases where you just have this combination of technology. And how is it available? On day one, did all of the video conferencing crash because every district in the country was going at it at the same time? Yes, there were some products that did that. And how do you recover from that? How are you teaching these students about how to use technology securely from where they are, from their homes? The district I'm in was able to provide individual devices, district-owned devices to every student. So the students are not mixing personal and school. That's a wonderful thing. It is right. Very unique. It is not something that is happening everywhere where there's one-to-one technology available. I realize this, and I know we're very lucky to have it. But in those cases where it isn't, it requires a lot more conscious discussion. And the topic of security and privacy was never talked about, other than in passing, as we take your security seriously of your children. And I think that actually is more of a disservice.
Right. And by all means, we're not calling out, you know, wagging the finger saying, oh, you know, you did this wrong.
No.
I think we all understand that this was a crazy situation that has on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour changed dynamically, and all of a sudden decision had to be made, and you go with the best hand that you're dealt at the given time. But what that doesn't do, that doesn't preclude from asking the question, right? To Dan's point, if you don't know, ask. You now know that if you're listening to this, you have three people that you can reach out to, and we can connect you all over the place. We're all in this together, and I think there's a lot that the security community can help bring to the table to help kind of sculpt what is being done.
One thing I was going to say there too, when you think about it, and definitely reach out, but also think, I got to imagine in every district, look across America, if you were a threat actor sitting on the other side of the pond, or even here, some of these threat actors are the students themselves now. But now you saw this coming in the sense that every student was going to need something to be able to get online, right? So if you're sitting back, you're like, wow, here's, you know, millions of students, which is millions of new devices, which are all going to connect in from a network, a home network, right? And why is that risky? Well, for one, if it's on the home network, which also, if you have all these other smart devices inside your house, are all tied into the same network. So first, did any of these school districts actually think about sending something out to say, hey, the students are going to be getting online. Here are the precautions we'd like you to set up a multiple networks within your home. And here's what you need in order to set up multiple networks. And here's why we're asking you. For one, it's to protect, like, let's say you work for a company and you have a work computer, et cetera, and you want this on this network over here, and you have all these other IoT devices, right? And why are IoT devices vulnerable? And we could get into all that, and IoT, Internet of Things. And let's talk about those devices and how they're used for DDoS attacks, right? Which are
distributed denial of service.
Distributed denial of service, right? And what's happening is people or threat actors are taking all these IoT devices and you build them up. And if they can get millions of them together to attack all at the same time, that's how you have this distributed, right? All these devices at once, denial of service. And I'm going to read this out loud. I thought this was very interesting. So how did this pummeling attack occur in Miami-Dade school this week? So the district said last week that the student admitted to pulling the strings behind 8 DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service attacks, targeting the district's networks, including the web-based systems needed for its online learning platform. The school system had actually been targeted about 24 times since the school year began, according to the Miami Herald. Investigators are trying to figure out who else might be behind the attacks besides that in particular student, who admitted to succeeding with an embarrassingly basic attack. He used a decade-old open source tool called Low Orbit Ion Cannon, LOIC, that even the most bare bones firewall should be able to catch. Okay. So when you guys were just having the conversation as school districts were getting ready, I actually reached out to an old teacher of mine, all right, who's a superintendent at a nice school system here, and was like, and this was before COVID occurred. And then after, he was like, you know, get back to me in April. So I did. I said, hey, you know, seriously, this isn't for me. I don't even handle school system. I was just reaching out to him because I'm sure as he prepares to get ready for the school year, they're wondering about the things they need to do. I was just going to offer him my opinion. And in this case, I could see something like this happening all over the country.
Oh, right. Yeah. Now. Oh, without question. And this, I guess the other thing is how can we better prepare or help our districts reinforce the need for this with taxpayers? It takes taxpayers to fund these kinds of initiatives and support that these are important. This is great evidence as to why we as taxpayers need to support these efforts, and they need to be part of the proposals that come out of the districts,
right,
in order to secure the districts.
Yeah, 100%. And pivoting back to what I was saying too about the school districts, if you're going to leave it to each school district to send a note home of why having a separate network set up for the student to be on while he's handling these classes, that's going to fall not just by deaf ears, but I don't think there's enough people or bandwidth to be able to do that, right? That needs to be coming
not
from
enough understanding at right. the level. Right.
And in small districts, there's one person that does this and is doing all of technology, if even a dedicated person to technology. It's not, yeah, it's not going to happen on a district by district basis.
Right. And then there's some people too, like when you say like, what are some of the things you need within your home to do it? And if you getting your internet through any one of the internet companies and you're using their router or, you know, modem inside your house, you may only be able to set up two total networks in your home. And there's reasons for that. So, and then if you're trying to tell them they need to go out and spend $500, right? Some people are going to be like, you know, and I think if I look online, there's, you can get certain devices, routers or modems put together for like $250 that'll give you the capability to have multiple networks.
But that is a huge amount. There's a whole equity discussion that goes along with this as well, but continue, sorry.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I just cut 500 in half to 250. That's what sales guys do when they walk into the room. You start with this really big number and then you just casually throw out. But you know, for like 250, you could do this.
But
it's a big number.
50? Even 50 yeah. is a hardship, and some yeah. don't even have access to internet based on their locations.
And that goes also to another discussion too, that I remember, I'm going to forget his name, but he's the head of security for, I don't know if it's Wayne or Detroit. Anyways, listening to him up on stage last year when he was talking, he goes, you know, it's interesting for all these practitioners up here to talk about the problems they have. He goes, imagine the problem I have. He goes, we're talking that most of the homes, you know, more than 50% don't have internet. And you're talking about even the streets that these people are on don't have streetlights, mm-hmm. right? Like, how are we going to go around and make sure that there's streetlights? And some of the ideas and proposals and things that he had come up with were actually really awesome. And he's given a limited toolbox to work with. So to Dan's point, right, to tell someone that, you know, it's only a certain dollar amount to go out and do it, would be difficult to do, you know, even for 20% of the population. So with that being said, I had a friend just recently reach out to ask the question, hey, I heard you talking about setting up multiple networks, or how do I protect the work computers that we're doing, you know, because we're working from home. What was that you were talking about? And I was like, absolutely. You know, like, feel free to reach out. Like, I'll send you an email and put it together. And maybe that's something we can come up with. Just put like a short little snippet together that we can share as part of our podcast with people about just simply how to set up a multi-network and why you would want to do that, and having different passwords for guest Wi-Fi versus, you know.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
It is a great idea. I think it's starting to be built into some of the newer mesh technologies now, that it's more of a button that you can just turn on for guest networks. And
right.
Which is great to seeing it built into the technology stack being sold to consumers.
But it's reinforcing
everybody.
But it's reinforcing the utility nature of connectivity and right. of technology, that these are things that are part, that are expectation, like wall power. And in the same way that we have to provide that for everyone, we need to do the same. Security as part of the technology comes under the same bucket. And that's how you take school, you know, K-12 public districted schools and make them secure, as if it's part, if it's baked into what they are funded to do, what they are chartered to do, and what they do. But in the meantime, K-12 districts are out there, if you're a technology director, if you are a superintendent, or you're a teacher at one of these schools, and you want to and you want to make connections to security professionals to help improve or reinforce or just review what's going on, get in touch with us in feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net, and we can point you in the right direction, either with us or with somebody who we know closer fit to where you are geographically. And with that, I'll also give the other ways to contact us. Greatsecuritydebate.net is the website, and Twitter is @securitydebate. please provide your feedback. We'd love to hear what you think of this and all the other episodes, ideas for upcoming topics, or other ways that I can say the word "it depends" and mean it. Thanks, Eric and Brian, once again. Really appreciate the great debate and discussion, and I look forward to next time.